Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dagena Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're really honored to have Professor Tansen Sen and Dr. Ryan Tsui on the show to talk about their new edit volume, Beyond Pan-Asianism, Connecting China and India, 1840s to 1960s, published by the Oxford University Press in 2021. Professor Sen and Dr. Tsui, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's so nice to have you. It's such a pleasure. I wonder if we can begin the interview with some self-introductions. Please say a few words about yourselves and how you became interested in East Asian studies and particularly in India-China connections.
So I'll go first. This is Tansen. So I was in China when I was 14. I came here with my parents. I'm now based in Shanghai. That's why I'm saying here. And I started my studies in Chinese language and literature right away, going to college and then doing my master's at Peking University. And it's at Peking University that I got interested in China-India connections. I worked mostly on the Tang and Song dynasties, looking at trading and Buddhist connections between the two regions. And then I went to University of Pennsylvania and did my PhD also on China-India connections, again on the Tang and Song dynasties. Since then, I've been focusing on different periods and different aspects of China-India connections. This book that we are going to talk about is mostly about modern to contemporary periods. So that's how I've extended beyond the Tang and Song dynasties. I used to be at the City University of New York in New York. In 2017, I joined NYU Shanghai. I teach mostly China-related courses here. And I also head a Center for Global Asia that looks at Asia more broadly. And some of the methods of doing Asia comes across in the book that we are going to talk about.
Thank you, Professor. And Dr. Tsui?
Hi, I'm Brian. I teach at the Department of Chinese Culture at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. So I grew up in Hong Kong, being immersed in sort of Chinese nationalist propaganda. I mean, the nationalist being the Kuomintang, because one of my grandparents was an ardent supporter of the Kuomintang. So he threw me sort of this Kuomintang books when I was like in my teens. So I became very interested in modern Chinese history. That's what I studied when I was an undergraduate and was a graduate student at Columbia University. I became interested in China-India connections when I was looking for a topic for my PhD dissertation, which eventually became my first book. China's Conservative Revolution, the Quest for a New Order, 1927-1949, which came out with Cambridge University Press in 2018. The guy I was looking at was Da Jitao, who was one of the few Buddhists with the Kuomintang administration, and he took charge of these sort of Pan-Asianist activities that the Kuomintang undertook, which brought him to India, and his connections with the Indian National Congress. And that's how I became interested in modern India-China connections.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really fascinating book. I highly recommend our readers to go and check it out too. So this edit volume, Beyond Pan-Asianism, is actually a really welcomed addition to the growing scholarship on the connection between India and China, especially in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So how did this collaborative project of Beyond Pan-Asianism begin?
Well, Brian, do you remember when was the first time we started talking about this project?
Probably 2012, when I was finishing my PhD.
Yeah, so Brian was at Columbia, and I was at CUNY in New York, both of us. And we started talking about interests that overlapped. And one of the issues we quickly discovered was this various archives, especially in Taiwan and India, that people really did not focus on to study China-India connections during the late 19th century to 20th century. And that's when we decided to do something about it, to look at archives, but also focus on the period. So we thought the period after the Opium Wars was not properly examined with regard to China-India connections. And then we also quickly realized that the two of us could not do it by ourselves because this seemed to be a huge project. So we thought from the very early on that this project would be a collaborative project. And that's how we started approaching people who were interested in this time period and also China-India connections. So we gathered a group of 5-6 people from different parts of the world. There were people from the US, certainly China and India. And the idea then was to apply for a grant to fund the research. And we applied and fortunately got the funding from the Chang Ching-ko Foundation in Taiwan. And that allowed us not only to meet regularly among the collaborators, who are also the collaborators to the volume that we are going to talk about, but also go to these various archives in India, China, mainland, and Taiwan, and also United Kingdom, where there's a lot of material from the British Library. So we met in different locations, and perhaps Brian could talk about those locations because he was the first to organize the first meeting in Australia. Brian, you want to talk about our meeting in Australia?
Well, so the project began when I was a postdoctoral fellow at the Australian China at the Australian National University. So we first met there. We gathered together a few scholars, some of whom eventually contributed to this volume. We met again for a few times in Hong Kong and also in Shanghai, to hammer out the themes and topics that each of us would work on. We eventually decided that the group that began the project was mostly consistent with historians, but then the group itself, the volume itself, as you can see, really covers a few other disciplines as well.
Yeah, and let me also add that we brought in other people who were also interested in this period, but also looking at new sources of studies. So one of the key contributions of this volume, I think, are the various kinds of sources that people have not necessarily used, or if they have used, then we were looking at those sources from a different perspective. So One thing that we realized quickly was that there were certain issues that was missing, but that's something that we can't cover everything. It was the problem. But I think we have done a comprehensive work and covered a lot of not only aspects, but also disciplines as we did from literature to Buddhism to political relations as well.
Thank you. Yeah. So we're going to talk about the methods that this edit volume takes in a later question. But before going into beyond pan-nationism, it's perhaps beneficial to first talk about pan-nationism. So what were some of the key figures and organizations that fostered these ideas of pan-Asianist solidarities, especially that entangled India and China together in the colonial and early post-colonial eras? What were some of the goals and results of these pan-Asianist visions?
So in the narrow sense, pan-Asianism began with the Japanese art historian Okakura Tenzin. He argued that Asia, specifically India, China, and Japan, belonged to one civilization, and Japan being the first to modernize and home to the sort of finest Asian traditions should assist this particular Asia to confront the West. So pan-Asianism had been evoked by politicians outside of Japan when they appealed for cooperation, most notably Sun Yat-sen's 1924 speech in Kobe. But this tradition was tarnished by its association with Japanese invasion of the continent that accumulated in what was known then as the Great East Asia War in the 1940s, stated aim of which was to liberate Asia from Western imperialism. But pan-Asianism in this volume takes on broader meanings because of its inherent ambiguities. Pan-Asianism could be part of or inspire both conservative and progressive politics. So in this volume in particular, Jiang Taiyuan was a Chinese revolutionary who held pan-Asianist and anti-colonialist sympathies. He participated in the short-lived Asia Solidarity Association in Tokyo. Tagore, which also features very much in this volume, saw pan-Asianism mostly in sort of idealist, culturalist terms that counter the savagery of modern capitalism. And of course, pan-Asianism also fed into wider third world solidarities, the most iconic expression of which was the Bandung Conference in 1955. Which Nehru and Joe and I played very interesting roles. So in this volume, we tried to explore pan-Asianism in its many fold and sometimes contradictory manifestations.
Thank you. And then going back to the title of the book, then a central argument that really emerges from this volume is that, quotes, pan-Asianism informs but does not necessarily define or exhaust stories of China-Indian interactions, unquote. So please tell us more about this point. What are some of the ways in which the scholars in this volume kind of move beyond pan-Asianist perimeters to reveal fresh perspectives and multidimensional perspectives of India-China relations?
Yeah, so when we applied for the grant, we had this idea of going beyond pan-Asianism. The reason for that was that we wanted not only to look at the intellectuals who were participating in this discourse that Brian just pointed out, but others who were part of India-China connections, who are not necessarily intellectuals, but businessmen, traders, but also migrant communities. So the idea was to not only talk about the elite of China-India connections, but also the subaltern of China-India connections. So I would just add that when the manuscript was going through the peer review, one of the reviewers suggested that we change the title and not use Beyond Pan-Asianism. But Brian and I insisted that that was the core reason we had that title was to move beyond this established idea of Pan-Asianism, which in many ways dictated how China and India connections were studied. And as Brian was also pointing out, Bandung was another stage after decolonization when Pan-Asianism was re-invoked. And Pan-Asianism comes back again in the 80s as well in the study of China-India connections. And beyond what Okakura had done, it became a way of looking at China-India relations by contemporary scholars. So one way we wanted to move beyond Pan-Asianism was to also set a new method of looking at China-India connections that went beyond what is called the friendly connections between China and India, starting from Tagore's visit to China in 1924 to the later periods, especially in the 1950s. So one was to go beyond this idea of Pan-Asianism that Okakura started in the early 20th century, but also to move beyond the way of looking at China-India connections from the period of opium wars and beyond. So those were the reasons that we wanted to use that term. And many of the chapters have looked at these both aspects of moving beyond Pan-Asianism. At the same time, we also discuss this idea of Pan-Asianism. So Tagore is part of the discussion. Binoy Kumar Sarkar, who was an Indian intellectual living in Shanghai in 1916. But other figures also show up. Chang Tai-yen, as Brian was talking about, is a major figure in this concept of Pan-Asianism. So we talk about Pan-Asianism, but we also move beyond Pan-Asianism, both with regard to the content as well as with regard to the method of doing China-India connections or comparisons.
Thank you, Professor. Yeah, indeed, this the chapters in this edit volume definitely goes beyond discussing just China and India, and especially painting their relationships in these kind of friendly solidarities. But it also goes beyond the use of artificial temporalities, right? Like you said, moving beyond the era of the Opium War or the time surrounding the Opium War. So in other words, this volume really kind of questions the use of these temporalities, but also nation-state frameworks. So can you maybe tell us more about these kind of methodological approaches and choices? How would they help us to grasp or contextualize the relationship between India and China better in a more effective way?
We de-emphasize conventional periodization that focuses on key milestones, such as the founding of the Republic of India in 1947 and the People's Republic of China in 1949, because the emergence of these two nation states pertains to only part of China-India interactions. Some aspects of China-India interactions, connections such as intelligence gathering in the border town Kalimpong, which I'm sure Tan San will talk more about later on, and the aspirations of Chinese and Indian shipping entrepreneurs can only be put to relief if we suspend these sort of state-centric temporal divisions. And of course, Tan San mentioned the subalterns, and these subalterns might not have very much to do with 1947 and 1949. So this is one reason why we want to de-emphasize these milestones. But the other reason why we want to de-emphasize this sort of dates, periodization, as Dikana also mentioned just then, is that we want to move beyond the nation states, because China-India connections are part of regional and global trends that go beyond sort of governmental or state-to-state relations. The circulation of people, ideas, capital, and imagery is often confounded geopolitical boundaries. Imperialist projects and anti-imperialist or national movements, and indeed capitalism transcended national boundaries and were sort of global ventures. This is particularly true, we argue, in the colonial period or the Republican period in China, or late Qing period in China, when due to various reasons, and most of all, in the weaker states, boundaries were much more porous than they are today.
Thank you. Yeah. And the introduction of the edit volume kind of mentions that some of these chapters in the book actually challenges categories and frameworks forged in the Cold War and addresses problems or limitations of area studies. And this is also something that Professor Sen, your article, China-India Studies, Emergence, Development, and State of the Field, recently published in the Journal of Asian Studies, talks about that we need a kind of new framework to analyze the complex connections and the pertinent comparisons between China and India. So the introduction of the edit volume then kind of suggests or mentions two scholars who have suggested the use of India and China as methods to study these two cultures, civilizations, and nations to challenge these Cold War categories. So Taiwanese scholar Chen Guangsing, for example, and the Japanese scholar Mizuguchi Yuzo have both suggested India, China as method. So in the edit volume, then, how are the scholars also engaging with this India, China as a method? Do they consider this as a approach to take in future studies?
So the article that you mentioned in Journal of Asian Studies is a state of field article, which also looks at the methods that have been used to study China-India connections or comparisons. And the motivation to write that article actually came during the process of doing research for Beyond Pan-Asianism book and writing the introduction. There seemed to be something missing that I thought should be put in writing that needs to be done by future scholars. And so the method was one key aspect, as I argue in that Journal of Asian Studies article, that this field might have started in the 19th century, but the method of doing China-India comparison or connections really has not been discussed. And the introduction to Beyond Pan-Asianism started that discourse, and the article then in Journal of Asian Studies took it forward. And I'll just mention before I answer your question that we are actually doing a collection of articles where people studying China-India, either connections or comparisons, are going to tell us about the methods they are using. So this is an ongoing process to talk about the methods of doing China-India connections. So I would say the introduction to this volume, Beyond Pan-Asianism, was a start. And we started by looking at what people had already done. And this is where actually, in Viren Murthy's chapter, he talks about Takeuchi Yoshimi's initial idea about Asia's method. I think people would know that not only this idea of Pan-Asianism, but this idea about Asia and what it was, how Japan was connected to Asia, was a huge discourse that continued even after the Second World War. And so this idea about looking at Asia as this not just a geographical entity, but common issues between Asia and other parts of the world, which I would say what Takeuchi was perhaps referring to is now called Global Asia. And I think Global Asia, when I run a center called Center for Global Asia, is not a constraint of Asia through the geography that we know of, but finding Asia in different parts of the world. So Americas is quite important. There were lots of Asian migrants who moved to the US, but also South America, Europe. That's what Global Asia is, how Global Asia is connected through Asia as a continent, but it's a broader issue. And that's what I think Takeuchi was emphasizing when he was talking about Asia's method. And certainly, as you pointed out, Mizuguchi Yuzo was looking at not Asia in particular. He was looking at China as method. And I would say this is also part of the Japanese scholarship on China, and they have been doing and writing on China from very early on. In fact, those of us who do China studies in the US have to look at the scholarship of the Japanese scholars. I don't know if you do that at USB, but at UPenn, I had to do 2 years of Japanese language just because we had to read what the Japanese scholars had written about the Tang and Song dynasties. But for Mizoguchi, I think the idea of China as method was also cautioning the Cold War narrative or the colonial narrative that we can look at Asia or parts of Asia through a perspective that comes from within Asia. And that's what I think Ching Kuan-Hsing also brings in, and he moves to India as method. His argument was, if you are really going to look at China and study China, can we use India as a method? So this was a different take that he was pointing across. And I think this is an idea that not many people in China have really looked at. So I would suggest to scholars who are doing India and China to look at these two arguments, one by Mizoguchi and the other by Ching Kuan-Hsing, to see if we can study China using India as a method and then look at China using India as a method. There's things to be seen from that kind of a non-Western, non-colonial, non-Cold War perspective. But this is not India-China as method. I think that's why we have in the introduction China slash India as method, not China hyphen India as method. In my article, I talk about China hyphen India as method. I think the other scholars have contributed to those ideas. Maybe at some point we'll get to that, which is not covered in this volume. But Peter van der Veer's study of China-India as method, or Prasenjit Dwara's China-India convergence that happens. So those are some things that are in the article. But so the introduction to this volume was the first step to start a discourse on that. And not everybody in the volume actually addresses this, but it comes out in different ways. And I thought Brian and I should emphasize that in the introduction. I don't know if Brian wants to add anything to this discourse.
Not at this point.
Thank you. Yeah, this really reminded me of another book that I've been reading recently, The Inheritance of Loss by Yukiko Koga. And so in the book, she kind of uses idea of the two mirrors kind of facing each other, the kagami awase. Like, so when two mirrors face each other, you get to see both, right? You can see sort of this infinite reflection of each other. You can also see each other's back. So I think this India / China method is a very powerful kind of methodology to really explore both regions in ways that is definitely not possible through this Cold War practice of area studies.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's a very interesting metaphor because there are so many interesting common issues between China and India historically and even contemporary that you can actually do this kinds of study without bringing in the Western examples. I think that's not been really outlined. Maybe people do it, but they don't examine the methods of doing that. So I think that's a very interesting metaphor. Holding the mirror to each other and looking at and studying each other is quite important.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So I guess part one and part two of the edit volume kind of talks about this, right? So we're holding the two mirrors, India, China, against each other. So part one of the volume actually features three essays that explore how Chinese writers engage with different meanings of India. So Adhira Mangalagiri discusses the Indian policeman in Chinese literature. Gao Gvili exposes Shudi Shan's China-India literary imagination. And Vren Murthy delves into Zhang Taiyan's critiques of colonialism. So how is India portrayed and understood in these Chinese writings? What do these kind of portrayals tell us about the imaginations of India-China connectivity through Chinese writers' eyes?
So part one of the volume complicates dominant thinking on Chinese images of India in the late Qing Republican period. So we are long under the impression that India did not feature in Chinese writings very much, or that if it did, Indians sort of features at the sort of the abject colonized slaves or the willing accomplices of British colonizers. So India as a society and nation was vanquished or something that China must overcome in order to become a modern nation. So this is the exact opposite to what Tan Sen was talking about as using India or China's method. So this is more of this sort of nationalist modernization theories type of linearity that we assume sort of dominates Chinese imaginations of India. So this, the three chapters in this part tries to complicate this stereotype. So Adhira's examination of the Indian policeman in Chinese literary writings points to instances where Indian policemen stationed in Shanghai, those supposedly obedient dogs of imperialism, acquiring revolutionary and anti-colonial consciousness. The Indian policeman appears as a more complicated figure who straddled between colonial sort of slave mentality and someone with whom the Chinese could join together in shared anti-colonial aspirations. Gao's chapter focuses on the short fiction writer whom Sanskrit and religion scholar Shudi Shan. Shudi Shan employs myths in Indian literature to question imperialist epistemology. He drew on circularity in myths to interrogate the teleology of historical process, a notion that held sway among modernizers in China and elsewhere. Vivian Murthy's readings of Zhang Taiyan, a very complicated anti-Qing activist, reveals that Zhang Taiyan liberated India in his critique of linear history. So together, the three chapters help us comprehend the many ways in which India was depicted in the Chinese intellectual world. India represented ambiguity, opportunity, and it also echoes the aesthetic part of our discussion just then. Chinese intellectuals using Indian experiences to rethink capitalist modernity and mainstream to the Chinese attachment to capitalist modernization.
Thank you. Thank you for really going into the hearts of each of these three chapters. And part two of the volume actually focuses on the reverse, right? How China was represented in Indian writings and also vice versa. So Zhang Ke's chapter, for example, looks at Chinese travel writings on India in the late Qing. Kamal Shio and Anand Young's chapters then examine popular perceptions of China written in Hindi, Bengali, and Urdu. So how is China represented in these Indian writings now? Do they also adopt this kind of linear temporality? What are some of the commonalities and differences between seeing the Indian-China connection through Chinese or Indian lenses or gazes now?
So before I move to the second section, I just wanted to basically point out that the first section, the authors of the three chapters were not the core members of our project when we started. And so we brought them in to really look at some of the issues that we thought, as Brian had earlier pointed out, was to go beyond what we were doing. And that's why the first section is called Epistemological Interventions. So Adhira, Gal, and Viren basically brought in a perspective that we were not covering initially. So that was the intention of bringing three scholars who were not really focusing on archival material, and they were looking at religion and literature. So that's the highlight of the first section as well. The second section, the contributors to the second section, which is called Encounters and Images, they were originally the core members of the research project. And the idea was to look at the archival and the library materials on China-India connections, but also look at some of these texts that had not been studied. So Changke's essay looks at Kang Youwei, who was in India, in Darjeeling, and writing about India and what he saw in India. But at the same time, what he was doing was reflecting on the situation in China. And this is after his reform movement had failed, and was India a method for China or not, was the discourse that Kang Youwei was actually having with his student Liang Qichao. One of the things that Changke looks at is not only Kang Youwei, but some other writers who visited India in the late 19th century. And these writings are actually quite important to understand the revival of India-China connections through the visits of people. And so we have a number of Chinese who are visiting India after the Opium Wars to see the situation and learn from India, whether or not India, British India, is a threat to the Qing or not. So what Changke does is not only look at these sources, but within these sources, look at how China is being thought about by looking at India. And I would say Qin Guangxing would be really happy to see this kind of a method. And although Changke does not really address Qin Guangxing, but he is actually working on India as a method by looking at Chinese writings on India. The other two scholars here, Kamal Sheel and Anand Liang, have been for a number of years now looking at Indian writings on China. And this, again, was another emphasis of our research project, is to look and bring out vernacular language material in Indian writings on China. And so they look at Hindi writings on China, but going beyond Hindi, Bengali as well. So starting from the early 20th century, there were lots of Indian writings in vernacular languages, especially Hindi and Bengali. And the two chapters by Kamal Sheel and Anand Young actually look at those perceptions and views about China within these kinds of writings. So we get a fascinating array of images of China in these Indian writings. So one of the key figures is the so-called subaltern soldier from India who goes to China and fights on behalf of the British army against the Boxers. And he writes about his views about colonialism both in India and China. And I would say this is one of the early comparisons of India-China and perhaps India-China as a method that he is using. And then what Kamal Sheel does is he looks at some of the libraries in India which also have writings on China from the early 20th century, and he focuses on them. So what this section really does is to highlight some of the sources that have not been used in India-China connections, but also look at non-state perceptions of India and China and self-perceptions of a region by people who are visiting each other. So these are studies of travelogues, these are studies of perceptions, these are perhaps the beginning of China-India as method by people who are not interested in the method parts, but I think this is the key aspect of the second section of the volume.
Thank you. Yeah, and writings in these Indian languages about China, are they also writing in this kind of linear temporality?
I think in Kamil Shields and Anand Yang's chapters, they have shown that these subaltern writings sort of somehow they sort of question the sort of this triumphalism, colonial triumphalism narrative discourse that you see in some of these sort of British writings on Boxer's Rebellion or the sacking of Beijing. So in this sense, sort of they offer a counterpoint to this imperialist historiography.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. And now let's jump to part three of the volume. So here we see how relations between India and China, facilitated by governmental, intellectual, and religious networks, were actually carried out on the ground at the turn of the 20th century. So, for example, Yuting Li's chapter looks into a conversation between the Chinese philosopher Feng Youlan and the philosopher poet Rabindranath Tagore. And In Tao's chapter investigates the evangelical Singh Sabha movement in Hong Kong and how it carries out there. Janice Hu Zhujiang explores wartime Chinese Islamic diplomatic missions across the Indian Ocean. And Dr. Cui, your chapter here charts the career of Tagore's Chinese protege, Tan Yunshan, and his building of this Sino-Indian cultural studies in India. So what happens when these ideas of solidarity, such as Pan-Asianism, were carried out in concrete practices?
So as you said, this part focuses on concrete practices of encounters. So in the previous two parts, we look mostly on images, but it's only in part three we look into specific cases of encounters. So Yuting Li delves into a conversation between De Yong Feng Youlan, who will eventually become a leading philosopher in modern China, and Tagore when Feng was still a student at Columbia University in New York. So the conversation led Yuting Li to reveal that understanding of Tagore in China was limited, and this limitation was a result of the very sort of famed or infamous 1924 visit that Tagore went to China, and it was then that the debate about Tagore was set, and whether we celebrate or reject him as a defender of Western civilization. So Yuting Li, by looking into earlier conversation, wanted to show another aspect of Tagore that somehow eludes much of our discussion of Tagore, particularly in the Chinese-speaking world. So Tao Yin homes into what for me a familiar but also unfamiliar site, the Sikh temple in Hong Kong. So Tao Yin maps out how the Sikh diaspora and in particular the Singh Sabha movement drew on both imperialist and anti-imperialist networks to raise funds and to establish bases offshore. Genesis chapter questions the Chinese Islamic Goodwill Mission's Chinese nationalist credentials by highlighting the transnational and heterogeneous connections across the Islamic world. She argues that the Second World War really strengthened the cosmopolitan networks of Chinese Muslims, while one might think that national wars would have hardened national identities. So this section named Cultures and Mediators discuss figures and encounters episodes that cannot be easily defined based on categories that we take for granted today based on national histories.
Thank you. That's definitely something that's very important that's coming through in this section and in these chapters. And Dr. Cui, your chapter entitled When Culture Meets State Diplomacy, the case of Gina Bavana traces the career of this really fascinating Chinese scholar, Tan Yunshan. But it also discusses Gina Bavana, this institution of Chinese studies founded in Shantikiketan that was inaugurated as a symbol of living contact between China and India. There's something very interesting about this place too. So please tell us more about this Chinese hall and what were the cultural promises it held and also the geopolitical challenges it had to negotiate.
Gina Bavana and Tan Yunshan were most intriguing entities. Tan Yunshan spent his earlier days in Malaya before being recruited to serve at Visvabharati, the institution that Tagore founded. Visvabharati was not your typical university, even though today is now recognized by the Indian state as one of the major universities. It prided itself in not having sort of classrooms in concrete buildings and formal curricula. So that's Tagore envisioned this place as the sort of this opposite of what you might find in Calcutta or Delhi, formal sort of urban-based universities, but rather institutions in a rural Bengal. Tan Yunshan was asked by Tagore to establish a Chinese studies institute at Visvabharati. Tan Yunshan's strength was in his connections with elite communities among the Southeast Asian or Nanyang Chinese and the Chinese mainland. Gina Bavana Chinese Hall, which he founded, was mostly a result of Chinese official to national government funding. He enjoyed cordial relationships with the Indian National Congress, which allowed him to mediate between the national government in Nanjing and the Indian National Congress, which was then still fighting against British colonialism.
So in the last section of the volume, entitled Building and Challenging Imperial Networks, now we see how India-China ties not only utilized and challenged imperial networks and later capitalist nation-state system, but also enforced them in many ways. So Madhavi Tampi's chapter now looks at Indian activists in Chinese treaty ports and cities. Liao Wenshuo's essay, for example, reveals the relationship between the nationalist Chinese government and India during World War II. And Reinhardt's chapter traces the shipping networks that linked India and China. Professor Sen, your chapter here then wraps up the section with a really interesting paper on intelligence gathering in Kalimpong. So how did individuals now involved in India-China connections build upon existing imperial and capitalist networks, and how did they also challenge these networks through their own movements?
So this section had, let's say, three objectives. The first thing with the overall objective of the volume to introduce new sources for studying China-India connections. And you'll notice that we are all using archival material in all the four chapters here. The second objective was to go beyond the temporal frameworks that have been used. So we did not stop with either 47 or 49. My chapter goes all the way to 1960s. So questioning that time frame that we were talking about initially. And the third objective of this section was to actually talk about non-state actors, even though they were using the state networks. And so again, the emphasis going beyond the nation-state framework. So these were the three objectives of this section. So Madhvi, who has actually worked on the National Archives in India a lot, I mean, she has collected a lot of information about the connections between China and India during the colonial period, the late 19th century in particular, looks at this group of Indian diasporic communities in China. It wasn't very large compared to the Chinese community in India. But they were participants in this anti-colonial movement. They were key members of anti-colonial movement that was based outside India. So the Gadar Party, for example, connections to Northern America through Shanghai was one of these key groups of people fighting the British colonial. And then the later, the very famous, especially for people in eastern part of India, Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose, who establishes this anti-British colonial movement in Singapore, also had representatives in China. So Madhvi is basically looking at these anti-colonial people based in China using the colonial networks to fight against the colonial government in India. So that's her chapter, again, bringing to fore some of the important sources on these anti-colonial connections between China and India. Wenshuo also does something similar using sources from Taiwanese archives and looks at the connections between the Kuomintang and the Indian nationalist movement at the same time as Chiang Kai-shek is talking to the British leaders in India. And then one of the figures that she talks about, and this was Brian's book about Taiji Tao, having discourse with the Indian nationalist leaders, for example, Nehru. And so that connection underneath the state-to-state relations is the fascinating aspect of Wenshuo's paper here. And Reinhard it's not about connections, but it's about comparisons, essentially, between two shipping magnates, you can say, very nationalist shipping magnates who are creating their own nationalist entrepreneurship using the pre-existing, mostly British-created shipping networks and how they deal with these changes that happens during the colonial period and during the decolonization period is a fascinating study of these two shipping nationalists emerging in India and China. My own essay here looks at archival material on the intelligence network that existed in a very small town in northern Bengal called Kalimpong. And again, the emphasis was to go beyond the established cities and look at other towns which are important also for China-India connections, because Kalimpong was linked to Tibet, and that is the reason why it emerged as a key site for spying activities, and that's what I focus on in my chapter, looking at again people who are not usually covered in the study of China-India connections.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. I like how in your chapter you situate not only kind of geographically into this area that's often kind of overlooked, but also temporally, right? You're kind of looking into the post 1949, 1945 moment, into the 1960s, and looks at how, you know, imperialist connections, but also other kinds of political forces have this kind of delayed effect on certain regions. So speaking of archives and the use of really interesting materials, your chapter actually uses and analyzes confidential reports produced by the colonial and post-colonial intelligence branch of West Bengal in your chapter entitled The Chinese Intrigue in Kalimpong, Intelligence Gathering and the Spies in the Contact Zone. So what did you find in these confidential reports about espionage in the region?
So one of the objectives of this chapter was to point out the nature of our archival material that we were using. And so in the chapter, I talk about how these archival files that are now at the West Bengal State Archives came about, how they were compiled, who were the people composing it, and how the British colonial government were really very much concerned about foreigners, especially the Chinese in Bengal, where a diasporic community of the Chinese had been established in the 18th century. So there are about 200 files compiled by the Intelligence Bureau of the colonial British government that continued after 1947 by the Indian intelligence branch, also working out of Calcutta. So as far as sources are concerned, these are really fascinating sources with regard to the Chinese presence in India, particularly Bengal, but extends to other parts of India as well. So just through these files, we can see a number of aspects of how the British colonial government and then the Indian independent government perceived the connections to China. This is usually not portrayed in other sources. So as far as sources are concerned, these files give us a very interesting perspective of the Chinese government, both the Republican government and then the Communist government. And that was one of the reasons to go beyond 1947 and look at how China is perceived by the intelligence people, which is very different from what the government was saying either before or after 1947. So what I found here were records of different communities, Chinese communities settled in different parts of Bengal. And I picked Kalimpong because it gave us a sense of how the identities of the Chinese migrant groups changed before and after 1947, when the idea of who is a citizen of India came about. And in that context, these diasporic communities and people belonging to these diasporic communities were mostly traders doing business or laborers working in the docks in Calcutta. Were then trying to adjust to the idea about where they belonged, whether they were Chinese or were they Indians. The Indian state, the Indian independent state, had a view about them. They were perceived as Chinese. And initially, until the 1950s, late 1950s, that was not a major concern, whether or not they had citizenship or not. But when the relations between the PRC and the Indian government started deteriorating, these people, these Chinese living in Kalimpong, were then thought of as spies. Many of them were perhaps not engaged in spying activities, and there are conflicting records from these files that would indicate that some of the informants were insisting that some of these Chinese were spies. Others were saying, no, they were not spies. So you see this conflicting ideas about the spying networks. At the same time, we know from other sources, especially Chinese sources in the mainland and Taiwan, that yes, indeed, some of them were providing intelligent information to the Chinese government. So one of the arguments I also wanted to make in this chapter was that archival research should not just focus on one set of archival library, but also compare it to the other archival material. And then in this case, we have a lot of information not only from Calcutta, the West Bengal State Archives, but also the Taiwanese archive and the Nanjing archives. So a comparison of these three archival sources would really tell us the extensive network of spies and the counterintelligence activity of different governments to stop that from happening. So that was, I think, one of the final say or objective of this volume, is to emphasize that, okay, you bring out new sources, but don't stick to one set of sources. See if you can find other sources that are either comparable or contradictory to what you are finding in one library or one archives.
Thank you. Yes, that's definitely something that all scholars nowadays actually have the privilege of doing, right? We have a lot more access to different kinds of archives, especially through digital means. So this is, indeed even more necessary than ever to consider multiple archives in our work. So Professor Prasenjit Srirara actually concludes the chapter, concludes the whole edit volume in the epilogue chapter. And here in this last chapter of the book, he sees how many of the chapters in this volume actually can be viewed through this methodological lens of convergent comparison. This idea that he also recently wrote about in the November 2020 issue of Asian Journal of Asian Studies in his presidential address. And this concept is also based on this idea that histories are circulatory and they confound linear national processes. So please explain this idea of convergent comparison a bit more for us, especially how our authors in the edit volume can engage with this idea. And also, how do you see it as a useful tool to study not only China-India connections, but also other transnational relations?
So Professor Srirara presents a methodological angle through which we can understand India-China connectivity. I think it's better to read directly from him in the epilogue. So I quote the concept, or the concept being convergent comparisons. It's based on the idea that histories are circulatory and not necessarily shaped by linear national processes. The method suggests that although there might be many different factors, institutions in different societies, they can often be understood comparatively through their responses to the common factors that impact them. So Professor Srirara argues that we should not treat, Professor Srirara argues that we should treat responses of individuals and forces not only in China and India, but I think perhaps in different societies to the shared conditions such as modern imperialism and foreign monopoly of economic and political powers as the basis of comparisons. So he stressed that figures back then, like the two shipping magnets that Ben Reinhardt studies, might not have discerned the common conditions shared by these different communities, societies, but we scholars would risk neglecting them if we confine ourselves to national or even nationalist histories.
If I could add a little bit on this, because you're working on transregional, transnational aspects. So Prasenjit's idea is actually quite important to do transregional and going again beyond Asia. I think that's why the idea is important, because it challenges this notion that transregional is always unidirectional from point A to B. And his idea of circulation or circulatory is things, if they move from A to B, can also come back to A. So this is a circulation that things don't stop. And other scholars have written about that. It's not point A to B, but also to C and back to A. And this, in my case, when I look at Buddhism and the long-durée transmission of Buddhism, you can see that happening not just between India and China, but Japan as well, and you mentioned Mongolia. So there's a whole lot of multiple directional circulation of ideas, and as you know, ideas then get transformed and sent back to the points of origin. I think that is the larger argument that Prasenjit is making. Things don't stop, they continue moving. And it's our duty to look at that continued movement to really understand the transregional connections and circulations. And I think the emphasis on circulation is something that he is also trying to make.
Thank you. Thank you. I think this is a great place to end our conversation for today. Thank you so much for taking up so much of your time to speak to us. But we do have one last question for the both of you. Can you maybe share with us some of the current projects that you're working on? And also, what would be one new book that you would recommend to our listeners?
Okay, so we are so now I'm working on two projects. One is on how fellow Asians outside of China in the British Empire, this crumbling British Empire in the 50s, debated the advance of the People's Republic of China. The figures I'm looking at includes Indian visitors to China in the early 50s, and Christians who wrestled with the idea of a communist-run China as their neighbor. So I'm now writing a paper on the Hong Kong, the Anglican Bishop of Hong Kong, Ronald Ho, who developed a very, very favorable view of the PRC and used this particular view of PRC to critique the colonial society of Hong Kong. The other project that I'm working on, I think Tan Sen will talk more about later on, is we have assembled a group of scholars to look at the papers that the Nehru family disclosed of the first Prime Minister of the Republic of India, and that they we try to see what we can do with these papers through our own sort of disciplinary and scholarly concerns. Well, as for the book that I might recommend, I'm now reading Pankaj Mishra's Bland, Fanatics, Liberals, Race, and Empire. It's not obviously not a research monograph, but it does point to many of the issues and predictions that we face in this sort of crazy age. In a tone, a language that most academics would rather not imitate.
So I'll start with the project that Brian mentioned. So one of the outcome of this Beyond Pan-Asianism volume was to continue working on archives. And then as we were finishing this book project, the archives that Brian was mentioning, the post-1947 papers of the first Prime Minister of India were declassified. And that provides a wealth of information about what happened in the 1950s between China and India. And we are using the methods that we used for the Beyond Pan-Asianism volume is to look at the 1950s from different disciplinary perspectives and not just on the international relations aspect of it. And that gives us various ways of looking at China-India connections in the 1950s, exchange of cultural delegations, various kinds of perceptions and encounters. So many of the things we did mostly for the pre-1940s period in the Beyond Pan-Asianism volume, we are using that to study 1950s China-India connection. My own writing now is on the invention of this term Maritime Silk Road. I've been interested in the Indian Ocean connections for some time, and also this term, the Maritime Silk Road. A lot has been written about Silk Road as a term, but who invented this term Maritime Silk Road and how it was used in the People's Republic of China and its association with the developments in the PRC is something I'm now working on. The book that I would recommend is actually a travelogue kind of a thing, written by a very famous historian of India. Her name is Romila Thapar. And she has done a tremendous work on early Indian history. But recently, just a couple of months back, she wrote a book on her travels in China in 1957. She went to Dunhuang to work on the paintings there. And this book is called Gazing Eastwards. And the subtitle is Of Buddhist Monks and Revolutionaries in China. So this is a fascinating take on China in the 1950s by this very famous Indian historian working on the Buddhist connections between China and India. And I would say this is quite an easy read, but it gives lots of insights into the scholarship on Buddhism, China-India connection, and how an Indian perceives China in the 1950s.
Wow, thank you. This is definitely on my reading list now. Thank you so much for recommending this. And Dr. Cui, also thank you for recommending your book. And again, I have to really say that, you know, I really appreciate both of you taking the time to speak with us about this really wonderful edit volume. Congratulations, by the way.
And thank you for organizing this, Dagana. And best of luck with your studies.
Thank you so much. All right, until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.